What's your favorite food at Thanksgiving? Is it the pies? The potatoes? Do you make your own cranberry sauce, or are you a canned cranberry evangelist? No matter what's on the menu, people pride themselves on the spread they serve up to their families during this holiday. But ahead of those celebrations tomorrow, we want to take a little time tonight to remember what a challenge food can be for some families. You're listening to And Another Thing. I'm Maya Schwader.
I'm Derek Kennedy. Whether you are preparing for a traditional Thanksgiving gathering full of food and family, recognizing the Pilgrims and Native Americans sharing that meal in Plymouth back in the 1600s, or you plan to un-Thanksgiving in recognition of our Indigenous people neighbors for Native American Heritage Month, or you're having a Friendsgiving, the truth is not every family or household will have food on the table. Food security, as defined by the United Nations Committee on World Food Security, means that all people at all times have physical, social, and economic access to sufficient and nutritious food. Food insecurity is defined as the disruption of normal eating habits of at least one household member due to a lack of resources or availability of food. That is a subset of hunger. Not having the option of eating when hungry and an ongoing problem with getting access to food to eat.
The USDA estimates a little more than 8% of families in Massachusetts experienced food insecurity in 2020. And this year, the National Hunger Relief Organization Feeding America estimated around 100,000 people in western Massachusetts struggled with access to food, including 15% of the region's children. The Food Bank of Western Massachusetts assists and supplies food to smaller food banks and pantries in all four of the Western Mass counties. We spoke to Executive Director Andrew Morehouse while he was in the middle of a major annual fundraiser. He told us that the pandemic caused the levels of hunger in the region to soar. Even now, the need has dropped only slightly.
At our peak, we were providing food assistance to 128,000 individuals every month. It's since dropped a little bit to about 105,000 people, but that's still 9% more than pre-pandemic levels. So I think at its peak, the month-over-month average was probably in the neighborhood of 30% increase over pre-pandemic levels.
I was going to ask, compared to 128,000, how many would you have in your average month before the pandemic started?
It was about 90,000 individuals, yeah, every month. And those are elevated numbers that had plateaued from as early as the beginning of the Great Recession. That's when we saw a dramatic increase in the demand for food assistance, and it plateaued at about that level. About between 80 and 90,000 individuals every month, and it never dropped to pre-Great Recession levels.
What has it been like trying to keep up with the elevated demand?
Well, clearly it's been stressful. We've rallied to the cause and the need, and in that sense, it's been extremely inspiring and downright rewarding to know that so many people care, and when we need to respond, the community is there to have our backs, and they certainly have proven time and time again that as a community we care about the most vulnerable in our communities, and particularly those who've been disproportionately impacted by the impact of COVID-19 on the economy, people of color, and always. The most vulnerable people who are, children and elders and people who have lost their jobs, which now reaches into the middle class. And so that's why the issue and the reality of food insecurity has become so visible and why so many people rally to support our cause.
Was there a demographic or a type of person who started frequenting the food bank who you were surprised to see there?
Yeah, certainly. Lots of folks who had jobs and, shared with us that they'd never been to a food pantry before and were honestly embarrassed to get on a line to ask for a bag of groceries, but they had no other choice. They lost their jobs and their income had run out. They had bills to pay, mortgages to pay, car payments, student loans, and you know, our answer always is you know, food banks are here for anyone and anyone who needs it at a moment in time. That's what we do. And so, you know, our challenge was to source enough healthy food so that we could meet the need of anybody who needed it with dignity and respect and confidentiality. And we'll continue to do so as we, you know, work to advocate for solutions to hunger. It's going to take time, and it's going to take policies and invest in our communities so that food security is something that we can live with, and we don't have to be constantly responding to.
So do I hear you saying that food should be cheaper?
Food should be less expensive. It should be more nutritious. It should be accessible to everyone. And for it to be accessible to everyone, we really have to get at what we like to call the underlying causes of hunger. The reason why people face food insecurity is because of so many underlying causes that run the gamut from, you know, obviously not having an income to be able to support one's family, but because they don't have income is an outcome, consequence of so many underlying causes, whether it be access to adequate affordable housing, transportation, childcare, education, healthcare, the list goes on and on and on.
Andrew Morehouse is the executive director of the Food Bank of Western Massachusetts. Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've heard Andrew Morehouse mention the numerous contributing factors that lead to hunger, starting with a lack of resources. Another significant challenge for many is a lack of transportation in both urban and rural areas that makes it difficult to regularly get to a source of healthy food. Mark Rondo, the director of the Berkshire Food Project in North Adams, tells And Another Thing that his group delivers food to people who can't get into town, and it's not only those in populated areas that are suffering.
We open our doors to distribute meals to people who come through in person about 11:30, between 11:30 and 1 o'clock. A delivery driver needs to go out earlier, so we have meals we need to prepare by about 10:30 in the morning. Most of our people come through a line and pick up their meals and some extra groceries, and so it makes it a more of a rush process. And of course, it takes a lot of the personal effort, personal interaction out of it. I mean, we do interact with our friends who come through the line, but you know, it's not like sitting down for a meal with someone.
30 years the program has been around. What type of numbers have you seen over the past 2 years? Right. So this is Thanksgiving now. Were your numbers really high last year as well?
The beginning of the pandemic, we saw it went way up as far as, but then as relief efforts went out and, you know, like SNAP programs through, you know, food stamp programs and other things, food school meals, so the community really pulled together. And so the numbers went down.
Do you find, Mark, that during these times you can call on volunteers? Our country is going through a labor shortage right now in many industries. Are you able to staff what you need to meet the demand during the holidays?
Yeah, yes, actually we are. And I think that it just shows the generosity of our community. And it also, I think a lot of times, you know, people who are retired or semi-employed or unemployed, we have a variety of people who help us. And I think a lot of it's the attitude we take that everyone's a friend, whether you need services or you're one of our volunteers.
You know, I know this may sound like a simple question because the answer can be, you know, money. But what more can be done to make sure that everyone has access to not just the food they need, but fresh food?
Well, you know, as being out here in a rural area, there is a lot of the farms and farmers markets. And I think that, you know, the awareness that people need fresh food is important. I think that that's one area with food deserts because, you know, your average supermarket does have a lot of fairly fresh produce and stuff. And as opposed to, say, a convenience store where they don't. And so I don't know. I think it's a multi-pronged question, but I think, you know, having enough stores that offer the produce, you know, encouraging people to take advantage of it. We give out a lot of fresh stuff, especially in the summer, and that's true of the Food Project and the food pantry in town.
Hunger is such a big story. How is it that towns can have food deserts? It just seems like it's unfathomable to think that a family of two or four has to drive so far. How do food deserts happen?
Well, I think that it depends. I know that the Price Chopper we had in town was an old building, and they just decided it wasn't feasible to operate out of that building anymore. And in the time since, it's remained vacant. And other people have looked to try to make it a store, but I guess it's a scaling issue, order. So I think a lot of it has to do with transportation. I think there are a lot of hill towns and mountain towns that not everyone has vehicles, and I think that there may be food deserts.
Mark Rondeau is the executive director of the Berkshire Food Project. Thank you so much for joining us on And Another Thing, and happy Thanksgiving to you, Mark.
Same to you, and thank you. I appreciate you talking to me.
When we return, we continue our look at food insecurity in our region and learn of a small but noticeable invention helping communities obtain fresh food in a big way. This is And Another Thing.
You're listening to And Another Thing. Before everyone tucks in for Thanksgiving, we want to take a moment to talk about food insecurity and why it remains high in this country. I'm Maya Schwader.
I'm Derek Kennedy. Data from a Connecticut food share survey of more than 1,000 residents taken 1 year after the coronavirus pandemic began indicated that food insecurity within households with children jumped from 41 to 44%. Even in a state as wealthy as Connecticut, its urban center struggles with food apartheid. Hunger is prevalent in each of the 42 towns and cities in Hartford and Tolland counties. That could sometimes mean making the decision between food, gas, or rent and bills. With only one full-service grocery store for the entire city of Hartford, Martha Page, Executive Director of Hartford Food Systems, explains the challenges of one of the largest food deserts in the area.
I'd love to start off by just defining a few terms. I understand that you are not a fan of the word food desert. Why is that?
Well, for a couple of reasons. It's an official designation, and we use it. What I don't like about it is a couple of things. One is that you will hear some activists talk about how that deserts are naturally occurring phenomenon, and food deserts are anything but naturally occurring. And it's also, you also have some people who object to characterization of their communities by folks essentially out of their communities. That's the second thing. And then the third thing that is kind of like, I don't think that it is nuanced enough. It doesn't explain enough about what food access issues exist and why they exist. And it really does not explain how it can be solved. Because if you put a grocery store in something in a place that is characterized as a food desert, you are no longer technically a food desert. But that doesn't mean that food is affordable. It doesn't mean that people without transportation can get to it. There's a lot of factors in food access that the definition of a food desert doesn't take into account sufficiently.
I want to seize on what you said about deserts being naturally occurring. There's a term that's arisen recently, I believe at least since 2018, when it was written about in The Guardian. It's this concept of a food apartheid. Which is the idea that it's not an accident that there are no grocery stores in certain communities. It's actually systemic. It's been planned that way. So have you seen symptoms of this or evidence of this?
Absolutely. I mean, we are in Hartford and recognize that kind of like every community is different. But there are things that are true about the food system in a city like Hartford that are true in many places. And this investment in urban cores for lots and lots of different kinds of businesses is certainly not a new phenomenon, and it is certainly not a new phenomenon or exclusive to our geography when it comes to grocery stores.
So if you had to list the top three biggest challenges for accessing food in Hartford right now, what would they be?
I'm not going to put these in any particular order, but I do think transportation is one of them. If you are working two jobs and you have a couple of hours in between your two jobs, and to get to the grocery store, to a major grocery store, takes you an hour bus ride. The math doesn't work on this. So transportation, ease of access that way. I also think that affordability is a big issue, that people that very often we find in households that are economically challenged, that food, the food budget becomes the thing that is most possible to squeeze. And then the third thing is that it's going to feel like a big, and this is not just a food issue, but it is a kind of like a just their geography issue, is that it would be so much easier in some ways to think about this more broadly than the town lines permit us to do. So the example that we sometimes use, and I love West Hartford, you know, it's a great community. West Hartford's got like 8 grocery stores with half the population. Hartford has 1. So it's kind of like, you know, but if you were in other parts of the country, there is no way that Hartford and West Hartford would be 2 different communities. So we have kind of like an allergy in New England and particularly in Connecticut in thinking about things regionally, but some problems that we face, not just in food access, but in education and lots of things, would more easily be thought about with effective solutions, I think, if we were able to think more broadly than the bright lines that our town lines represent.
I understand there are some development and redevelopment discussions underway in Hartford right now. Is food retailing or food access on the agenda at all?
Absolutely. We've been working on a project with a number of partner organizations and, most importantly, with strong community voice in what's needed. That, you know, like, you know, we've been working on the north end of the city, which tends to be more poorly served for grocery retail than other parts of the city. It takes a long time to do this, and bricks and mortar grocery retailing has gone through a lot of changes over the last several years. You know, online shopping and the supply chain issues that we've seen throughout the pandemic and currently, this is not an easy business to be in.
Martha Page is the executive director of Hartford Food Systems. Thanks so much for being with us, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
All right, happy Thanksgiving to you. Thank you.
You may have seen what looks like random vending machines just sitting on a street in some local neighborhoods. They may be colorful, have street art decor, and likely a message written on the front. But inside, no quarters necessary, is food. Fresh for anyone to access or donate to if you're not going to use that gallon of milk after all. The idea for these machines in cities and towns around the world is to reduce food insecurity and increase food equality on a grassroots level. Our Jill Kaufman from New England Public Media reports on the public refrigerators that have popped up in communities around Massachusetts.
In downtown Worcester, Trevor De La Pera is helping unload a few dozen apple pies into an outdoor refrigerator. They're those boxed little snack pies.
This was a godsend for the people in the community. This fridge will be stocked right now. Come back in 5 minutes, it's empty. Come back in 20 minutes, it's full again.
This fridge is a community fridge. It's painted bright blue. The words free food are stenciled on the door. De La Pera owns a food truck right nearby. He is one of 50 volunteers who check regularly this and several other fridges around Worcester.
So we have little temperature monitors up here. It's one of the first things I check because every now and then it'll maybe trip a breaker or, you know, something's not quite right.
Kathy Petke is another volunteer. She's checking to make sure the donated food in the fridge is fresh and that it meets the guidelines. Fruits and vegetables, unopened dairy, prepackaged meals, all good. But no homemade food, no raw meat or fish, and nothing expired.
We've got it here. We've got a lot of bread. We've got some nice juices that just came in this morning. In the drawers here, we've got some kohlrabi. Those have probably been there a couple days now. I think nobody really knows how to use kohlrabi. It's an intimidating vegetable.
The community fridge movement began as a way to address hunger, but also to address food waste from households, from restaurants, and supermarkets. And full-sized fridges are encased in shelters built by volunteers. Businesses or private residents host the fridges and pay for the electricity.
The freezer, we've got lots of frozen veggies, Got some frozen waffles. It looks like the person who stopped by earlier took some frozen waffles and a couple of frozen meals.
The older man came by while we were talking. He poked around the fridge like you do when you're looking for something to eat and you're not sure what's there, after he didn't stop to speak with anyone. And Petke says she tends to give fridge users their space.
I can understand that it's a difficult time for anyone who needs to utilize something like this. So I'll say hello, I'll smile, and they'll usually say hello back.
The Worcester Community Fridge's partner with local farms and restaurants, the volunteers try to get prepackaged meals because not everyone can cook and not everyone has a kitchen. The blueprint for many community fridges comes from an organization called Freege. That's FREEDGE. The website offers guidelines for how to get a fridge. It has details about Good Samaritan protections that could essentially protect volunteers from being sued. And the Freege website has a map showing hundreds of setups around the world. This summer in Western Massachusetts, a group of volunteers set up a fridge on the bike path in Florence. And there are fridges listed in Franklin County and up and running in Boston.
I think they're a community-based response to what is a growing problem with a pandemic of food insecurity, and people are trying to help out their neighbors.
Andy Fisher wouldn't discourage anyone from donating to a community fridge, but the problem of hunger is systemic, he says. Fisher wrote the book, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. A community fridge is nice, Fisher says, like one of those little free libraries that pop up in a neighborhood, but
it is a distraction from the systemic issues and from the real solutions to the deeper problems that we seem to be avoiding as a society. We need higher incomes. We need better government supports. We need to re-examine capitalism, essentially, to see whether it's really meeting the needs of everybody.
People have come here and have kids. And it says, you don't know how much this means to us because it helped us to make ends meet. We have food stamps. How far can that go?
In Worcester, Trevor De La Parra isn't trying to solve world hunger. He was homeless once and hungry. Now he says he's an entrepreneur. When he's cooking in his jerk chicken food truck and people show up at the community fridge nearby,
I call them and offer them a plate of food because what is a plate of food? What is a plate of food?
It could be just enough to get you through another day. For New England Public Media, I'm Jill Kaufman.
Little fridges are certainly a way to help out in your community. Thank you for joining us today and for following us on social media. Find us across platforms at AAT on NEPM.
We also want to thank our And Another Thing team, Maxie Jackson, Mark Deegan, Alexandria Severo, Denise Vozella, and our technical director, Betsy Cordes. I'm Maya Schwader, wishing you a great holiday.
You can find food charts on food security, details for each state, and more information on our show page at nepm.org, where you will also find our past episodes. I'm Derek Kennedy. Happy Thanksgiving. Happy Hanukkah. Have a safe holiday weekend. And Another Thing returns on Monday.